Deconstruct 2006 presents Paul Hammond and Simon Willison, web services for fun and profit.
As Richard said, I'm Paul, this is Simon, and we work for the technology development team at Yahoo in London. We've got quite a lot to talk about this morning. We're going to be talking about how web services are used by large companies, and we're going to talk about some of the problems that we have at Yahoo and explain why APIs and web services are so important to us. We're hopefully going to share some of our experience with you. One thing we're not going to do is we're not going to go into any technical detail. Hopefully Jeremy, who's following us, will be covering that in the next session. But before we go any further, I think it'd probably be helpful to provide some context about Yahoo.
Okay, so Yahoo's kind of an interesting company in that it does a huge amount of things, and it's quite rare to meet someone who's actually got a, even within the company, who's got a good idea of everything that's going on at Yahoo. So obviously Yahoo has a search engine, and there's Yahoo Mail, which is an extremely popular webmail application. And then there's things like Yahoo Messengers. Then there are the newer products. This is Yahoo Answers, which has just launched in the UK and is already proving that British people ask much smarter questions than Americans do. Here's Yahoo Personals for finding love. There's Yahoo Movies. Yahoo Finance. And of course, that's English language sites, but Yahoo spans multiple countries. I think we have websites in 32 different countries and a whole bunch of different languages. So this is Yahoo France, and this is my personal favorite. This is Yahoo Korea, which always looks really pretty on a slide, I think, and often does the things that Yahoo in the US do, but with a distinctly Asian slant to them, which is really interesting. And then there's the new acquisitions. So hopefully everyone in this room knows about Flickr. There's Delicious, which is the social bookmarking service. And there's Upcoming. This is Upcoming talking about Deconstruct, which is our social event listing site. And there are other new acquisitions like WebJ, which is a social playlist thing. But the important thing, the thing I'm really trying to get across, is that not only is Yahoo the biggest website in the world, and we've got numbers to back that up, there are over 500 million unique users visit Yahoo-branded properties every month. And that's an awful lot of people to cope with. 200 million of those are active registered users, so they have a Yahoo ID and they sign into the site and they do something with it. And that all adds up to 3.9 billion page views a day across the whole Yahoo network. So this is a huge amount of traffic, huge amount of people. And as I mentioned earlier, this is a really varied line of products. So Yahoo can kind of be, you can think of Yahoo as almost a coalition of 40 smaller product groups, some of them from external companies, some of them developed internally, all working together more or less to put this massive network, to get this massive network up on the web.
So the big problem that we have is that building a site this big is hard work. There's a lot of problems that we face, some of which some of you will be familiar with, and some of them you probably won't know that much about. For example, we've got hundreds of engineers, and coordinating that many staff and getting them to all build products at the same time can be a very difficult thing to do. Jeff Barr talked a little bit about Amazon's infrastructure. We've got the same problem, thousands of servers across many different data centers, and coordinating that can be a big problem. And unlike many startups, we have to worry about uptime. If Yahoo goes down for even 10 minutes, then people can't get at their email, they can't talk to their friends, they can't search the web, and they get really annoyed, and it would probably reach the news. Then we have the same problems that everyone else has, but we get them much worse. We get more hacking attempts than pretty much anyone else. We store more user data than anyone else, and so we have a lot more concerns about privacy and what we're going to do with that data. These kind of problems aren't unique to Yahoo. As I mentioned earlier, Jeff has talked about Amazon having some of the same kind of issues. They're what you get when you need to scale. And I know that we've promised to go behind the firewall, but we checked, and we're not allowed to give you too much detail. So instead, what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at a hypothetical example of the kind of issue that we face and how we go about solving that. So we're going to talk about login forms, user preferences, user accounts. Pretty much every single website out there now, somewhere on the site, has the ability to create an account, to log in, and the website will store various bits of information about you. So here it stored my website address, where I live, my favorite color. E-commerce sites will store your credit card information. Personal sites will be storing a lot of personal information about you. And the easiest way to handle that would be to have a user table in your database. Here we've got a column for username, a column for password, a column for the email address. And then anytime your application wants any user data, it goes to talk directly to that user database. And there's some problems even with the simple example I've just outlined just there. There are security issues for a start. If you're storing credit card information, you can't just put it in a database and have no access controls on it. And you don't really want your password stored in the clear either. The problems get worse when you have multiple applications all talking to one user database. The data that's stored in that database, maybe the credit card information or particular information that's only relevant to one application, is available to all applications. And when you start to think about scaling that database up to tens of millions or hundreds of millions of accounts, you can't really store it in one database table. There are ways and means of scaling a database to hundreds of millions of accounts, but they involve a lot of work. And making those kind of changes when you have lots of different applications all talking to one database is a really hard thing to do. You'd need to get all of your engineers to stop what they're doing on their various products, to stop making money for the company, and all stop and start and coordinate one change to that user database. And if you think, we make changes to that user database many times a year, and we can't stop everything while that's happening. So how do we cope with these problems? Well, it's the theme of the conference. There's an obvious answer. With APIs, of course. So if we take that example of a user database, if we instead of talking directly to the database, we talk to an API, then we can solve many of these problems. That API will expose some fairly simple methods. So it will give the applications what they need to know. The applications will be able to ask for user data. They'll be able to validate that the user is actually who they say they are. And we can put access restrictions within that API so only the right applications can get the right information. This gives us a separation of concerns. We can put all of the information that's actually relevant to where that data is stored, how we store it, how we're coping with scaling, how we're coping with security, behind the API, and the applications can just use that API simply, and all they need to worry about is their particular bit of business logic. It means that we can change the implementation behind the scenes without having to go around and change every single application. So if we need to fix security problems, maybe add some more security, we can do that without stopping everything else. And if we need to increase our scale or increase the amount of redundancy we have available, then we can do that too. The key point here is that internal APIs make scaling huge sites possible. Without an internal API for things like user information or some of the examples Simon's going to show later, we wouldn't be able to build something the size of Yahoo. It doesn't solve all the problems. We still need to worry about capacity planning. We still need to occasionally worry about how we're going to do upgrades. But without the API, it just wouldn't be possible at all.
So those are kind of the sort of dull business reasons that you need to be using this kind of infrastructure internally. But it's not just about being able to scale things up and have smarter architecture and stuff. It also enables a whole bunch of new ways of innovating and new ways of developing products. And we've sort of come to call that internal mashup culture. So I'm going to show you a bunch of examples of mashups within Yahoo that take advantage of internal APIs and kind of reflect the mashup scene that's happening out on the real web, but sort of within a corporate setting. So the first one I'm going to show you, and this is my favorite thing ever. This is really, really fun. This is Flickr's brand new map functionality, which they launched, I think Monday of last week. And it uses Yahoo's Maps API to pull in maps and then show you photos on them. So you can browse around the world. This is, I've zoomed in on Brighton here, so hopefully that map within a few hours will be cropping up extra photos from Deconstruct. You can zoom around the map, you can browse photos, you can explore, you can see all of the photos with a certain tag, so you can see all of the zoos in the world, things like that. And that's really fun, but the interface for adding stuff to maps is is through drag and drop. So people can pull up their photos in a bar along the bottom, drag photos onto the map to set the location. And it's a really simple sort of intuitive user interface. But thanks to that, within the first 24 hours, they had over 1 million photographs added to a map. And I think now, 2 weeks later, they're over 3 million. So this has proved to be a really popular feature. And it's given Yahoo this enormous amount of information about the world that just didn't exist before. Because, of course, when you drag a photo onto a map, you're also associating the tags for that photo with that particular location. And the possibilities for stuff you could do with that are really interesting. And as I mentioned, this is an internal mashup. So what we've got here, we've got Flickr, we've got the Yahoo Maps stuff. And when you combine them, you get this wonderful new Flickr Maps application.
And that's kind of a sort of big wow kind of application. But that, this stuff works on a much smaller scale as well. This is Yahoo Avatars, which is a fun little service on Yahoo that lets you create a cartoon version of yourself by selecting like different glasses types and things that can act as your representative online. And so here I've tried on the Steve Jobs look. I've got the black polo neck and everything. And you can put these things together in one place on Yahoo Avatars, but then they get reused across all sorts of different places in Yahoo's sites. So this is Yahoo Answers, which I mentioned earlier, and you can see that that a small version of the user who asked the questions avatar is displayed next to each question. And behind the scenes, what's happening is the avatar team provide an internal API that any Yahoo property can use to integrate again and say, I've got this user, just send me over their avatar so that I can display it. And the beauty of that as a system is that it means that when you're developing something internally, you don't even have to talk to the avatars team to start playing with that functionality. So Paul and I built an internal prototype a couple of months ago and decided to stick avatars on there to see if they were going to work out for it. And it took us, we looked up the details on the intranet, we wrote a few lines of code, and we had these avatars, all without any communication overhead with the avatar team themselves. That's not to say that you're killing communication and meetings stone dead, because, of course, once you want to launch a product, you need to coordinate with them and make sure they know how much traffic to expect from the new products that's using them. But it shows that just some small thing like avatars can then be used on dozens of sites throughout Yahoo without a huge amount of communication and development overhead fixing that feature up. This is avatars in the Yahoo Messenger client as well. So it's an example where they're being pulled off the web and onto the desktop. So one other mashup, and this is an interesting one because it pulls in elements of editorial as well, is Yahoo Tech. Yahoo Tech is a technology site for sort of mums and dads and non-alpha nerds who just want to just want decent advice about the products they're going to buy, and they want it with a sort of human voice to it. But under the hood, Yahoo Tech's another one of these internal mashups. It's using Yahoo Answers to provide a question and answers around your consumer electronics feature. It's pulling in Yahoo Shopping APIs to actually let people do comparisons on the site, so they can pull data in from the shopping APIs. They get a nice interface for saying, these are the three camcorders I'm interested in, now let me see the details. And we have an editorial team as well who are writing new content from the site. That's actually that's the Yahoo Tech Monkey. Well, it's actually a chimpanzee, but don't tell them that. Which they hired to do promotional events, which I think is just like the best thing ever. I love that. So that's Yahoo Tech. Final one I'm going to show you, this is Yahoo Travel's Trip Planner. And this is another application developed entirely in-house, a very small team. And they built this tool that lets you, when you're going on a trip somewhere, say Chicago, it lets you build an itinerary by saying, show me all of the restaurants I might want to go to. Here's my flight. I fly in here. These are the places I might want to visit. And lets you build this trip planner. And then, of course, you can see the trip plan on a map. So it's pulling in the Yahoo Map stuff. And once you've gone on the trip, you can tie it into your Flickr photos from that trip as well. So not only do you plan the trip on the site, but you then create a trip journal, which is published and which other people who are thinking of going to that place can use as well. So this is sort of there's an enormous mashup. You've got Flickr photos, you've got the Yahoo Map stuff, you've got the Avatars APIs in there. There's data being pulled in from Yahoo Travel, and there are a couple of internal APIs. There's a ratings API and things which are used as well. So this enabled quite a small team to build quite a quite elaborate website, just standing on the shoulders of the other work that had gone around that had happened at Yahoo. So the key point we're getting at there is that web services allow large organizations to build new products faster and do it with less communication overhead. So you don't have to ask for permission before you start using another team's API. You can build the thing up and then go to them later and say, well, this is what we've done with your platform.
So Simon's talked about how APIs help us build products faster, but most of the products he's talked about were actually kind of part of our normal product development process. Someone in senior management had come up with an idea. They've got some budget, they put together a team, the team designed the product, built it, tested it, launched it. But Yahoo's a big company, and so the kind of ideas that make it through that process tend to be the ones that are good for generating revenue right now, today. And it's easy for new ideas, more out there ideas, ideas that maybe aren't immediately obvious or useful to fall through the gaps. So one of the things that we're thinking about a lot within Yahoo at the moment is how we can focus on innovation, how we can encourage that kind of thing. So what we created is what we call Yahoo Hack Day. And obviously when we say hack, we're talking about the correct meaning of the word hack. as an appropriate application of ingenuity, as in a clever, beautiful use of computers, not breaking into websites and stealing credit card numbers. We didn't come up with the idea of Hack Day. We actually stole it from a company called JotSpot, who called it a hackathon. They stole it from someone else who stole it from someone else. It's not an original idea. And the idea behind Hack Day is to give some space to the people we have around the organization who have a great idea, have the capability to build a demo that will show it off, but just need some time to actually build that demo. So every few months, somewhere in the organization, we have a Hack Day. And if someone wants to, it's not compulsory, they get some time off from their day job and they can take part. And when they take part, there's 24 hours, and there's two rules during those 24 hours. The first is that you've got to build a prototype in a day. It's not enough for you to put together a PowerPoint presentation or a couple of mock-ups. It's got to be working code. It doesn't have to be bulletproof. It doesn't have to be scalable. It can be buggy, but it needs to demonstrate the idea. And once you've built that code, you then demo it to your colleagues. So we'll get together in a big room. Everyone gets, you know, 90 seconds, 2 minutes. They get to demonstrate their idea. Everyone comes along, takes a look. Key thing about Hack Day, it makes people happy. That's the main reason we do it. That's the main reason people take part. And that's why we keep doing it again and again. People really enjoy taking part. It's nice to be given some time off from the day job, some time off from the grind, some time to do something that you're self-directed and something that you enjoy doing. But Hack Day is also about innovation, and it's innovation through making stuff. This means that once we've got an idea, we can prove that it actually works really quickly. So many ideas are shot down through people saying, oh yeah, but do we actually know whether or not we can build that? And whereas at Hack Day, you can present it and say, look, I know it works because I've made it. It means that we can get things into user testing very quickly after Hack Day, and we've had some things go into user testing less than a week after Hack Day. And it means it's much easier for us to get things to market because we've actually got something to base our product on. Hack Day itself is also a hack. It's an organizational hack, and it demonstrates to the non-engineers in the organization, either those that have never done any engineering in their life or those that stopped doing engineering 10 years ago, that the people on the ground, the engineers, the developers, the designers, the producers, they're full of great ideas. And if you just give them a bit of space, then they'll come up with something that you'd never even thought of. Now, Hack Day, like everything else we presented, wouldn't be possible without APIs. Between 2/3 and 3/4 of all of the hacks that get presented are based on existing internal APIs. We do get some things that have been built from scratch using some of the web frameworks, but they're few and far between. And the reason for this is simple. If you were going to build something that's based on geographic data or needed avatars or something that needed, like, our search index, then in 24 hours, you couldn't have even managed to find a source of map data. You wouldn't have been able to pull together something that allows you to drag and drop. You wouldn't have been able to put together the infrastructure to do full web search. Without the APIs, you wouldn't be able to pull together most of these ideas in just 24 hours. Hack itself encourages the building of those APIs in turn, because people enjoy being part of Hack. So when they're building their products, they make sure that they're hackable. So we've got this virtuous circle where Hack encourages the APIs, and then the APIs make hacking easier. The key point I'm trying to get to here by talking about Hack Day is that these internal web services help us innovate. They make it much quicker for us to build a product, which means it's much easier to test whether or not it's going to work, without having to kind of look ahead, without having to do long planning, without having to spend a long time building something. And so it means that we can spot the problems, the products that aren't going to work much quicker, and we can spot the products that are much quicker as well, which makes it much easier for us to innovate.
We've talked about internal APIs and the benefits you get from them, not just in terms of sort of technology and scaling things, but also in terms of actually building exciting new things and enabling things like Hack Day. But of course, that's only half of the story. The other half is external APIs, and those with Yahoo are tied together on this one site, the Yahoo Developer Network. This is developer.yahoo.com. And YDN is actually a very small team. It's But what they do is they, within Yahoo, they evangelize the importance of APIs and they advise teams on the different products on how to construct their APIs and the best ways to make them available. And then they pull all of this stuff together on the one site, which has a full list of all of our APIs. It makes sure that they're all documented, that they've all got sort of user communities and mailing lists where people can go for support. And other benefits, such as developer centers, which are sets of tutorials and example code for, at the moment, PHP, Python, and JavaScript, and other languages coming online soon. So this is the one site that pulls all of this stuff together. And Yahoo has a huge number of APIs. I'm not going to list all of them, because there are dozens. But instead, I'm going to try and highlight some of the most interesting ones and look at some of the smart things people have done with them. So obviously, Yahoo is a search company, and as a search company, the search APIs are a sort of key part of Yahoo's overall offering. So Yahoo's web search engine has an API, which means that any query that you run through the through Yahoo Search itself as a user, you can also run programmatically from code by calling out to this web service API. But it's not just web search. There's also image search, video search, audio search, local search, which is restaurants and venues and things, and new search as well. So so you've got this whole chunk of sort of vertical search engines that you can run queries against. The search APIs are also accompanied by a couple of interesting smaller tools, which again build on Yahoo's internal technology. There's a spelling suggestions API, which is the same technology that's used on Yahoo for if you type in a search and you don't get any results, and it says, well, hey, did you mean this instead? So this isn't just, it's not just a spell checker, it's also trained by years of collected data about the kind of misspellings that people make in the wild. So you might put in a spelling, you might put in d.construct and get deconstruct back. This is actually a query we ran on the API to try it out. A far more interesting one, and one that I think is pretty unique, is term extraction or content analysis. What this API does is lets you send in a block of text, and you can pull that text from anywhere. You send it into the API, and it will then use some sort of Yahoo secret sauce to analyze that text and try and figure out what the key terms within that text are. So you feed in this description of deconstruct, and the term extraction API will pull out these, and again, this is a live query that we ran, that will pull out these terms and use them to summarize what the text was about. There are multiple output formats as well. So there's a lot of developer convenience in that if you're old school, you can pull back XML and start processing that. If you're a PHP developer, all of the search APIs can actually output serialized PHP, which means you get a data structure which you can just load up in PHP and start manipulating straight away. There's no need to write any XML parsing code. And other languages get the same benefit from JSON output. So JSON is the JavaScript object notation, which is a sort of subset of the JavaScript specification, which just pulls out the core data structures and makes them available not just to JavaScript, but to any language that has a JSON library. So you'll find Python developers and Ruby developers can pull back JSON instead of XML and, again, not have to bother with any manual XML parsing. And here's an example of a service that's been built using the Yahoo Search API. This is a company called Rolio, who they're actually using the Search API commercially to power this, a concept of user-specified search engines. So you can go onto Rolio and say, well, I'm an expert in Python, and I know that these 10 sites are the absolute best sites around for getting information about Python. So I'm going to feed them into Rolio and create a search engine which will only search those sites. And then you can share that on the web. So you can see you have search roles, they're called, that other people have created that are shared on the website and that other people can then use. Now, a far more techie demonstration, but this I really like this one because it demonstrates the kind of smart things you can do with term extraction, is this this is a problem which a guy called Matt Biddulph, who used to work with the BBC, came up against, where he had a list of names of politicians, and he wanted to take that list of names and turn it into a sort of graph of connections between the politicians. And he found a way of doing that was completely automated using a combination of the Yahoo Search API, the Term Extractor API, and Wikipedia. Because what he realized is that each of these politicians have a Wikipedia page. And for the most part, you can just take their name and use it and tag it onto en.wikipedia.org, and you'll get a page about them. But that didn't work all of the time. For some things, there'd already be someone else in the data in Wikipedia with that name. So you'd be looking at a name with a one or politician or something after it. But the solution to that is to, instead of going straight to Wikipedia, run a search against a search API. He used the Yahoo Search API, saying, well, I want pages about Tony Blair, and I want them in on the domain en.wikipedia.org. And the natural ranking mechanisms with the search engine guarantee that you're going to get, as the top result, the page that's actually about that politician. Of course, once you've done that, you can pull in the Wikipedia page, and then he ran it through the term extraction API to pull out the interesting terms, which he could then cross-reference against his list of politicians. So you combine those two APIs and that idea of using Wikipedia to normalize terms down to a single page, and you could automatically plot graphs like this. It's a really nice example of term extraction actually being used in the wild to solve a real problem. I think the last API I'll be talking about in detail is the Maps APIs. Now, This is a screenshot from Yahoo Maps showing a satellite view. There's an interesting technology at play here where the satellite view uses image processing to actually stitch tiles together smoothly. So whereas you might normally see the outlines of individual tiles taken at different times, with this there's a nice blurring feature to give you a more natural image. But the map APIs are available in two different principal formats. There's an AJAX API, so that's for the JavaScript developers, and that's what Flickr used for their Flickr Maps implementation. It means that if you're a JavaScript programmer, you can embed a Yahoo map with the zooming and the panning and all of that sort of stuff and start feeding data onto that. But there are also Flash APIs. Now, I'm not the world's biggest Flash fan, but there are a bunch of things that you can do in Flash that you just can't do in JavaScript. And I'll show you an example of that later on. But I think the most exciting thing about having Flash for a mapping API is that you've got all of these hundreds of thousands of Flash developers who turn their nose up at JavaScript because why should they deal with a language where you have to write different code for different browsers when Flash already works across everything they're targeting? And now that there are maps available that they can embed in Flash, you're opening up this sort of map mashup concept to a huge range of to a completely new audience of developers. I'll just show you a couple of examples of things people have built with maps. This is iamcaltrain.com by Cal Henderson, and this is a site that shows you all of the stations in the San Francisco Caltrain railway system. And for each one, it plots them on a map. And for each one, it can tell you when the next northbound and southbound trains are. He actually scraped the Caltrain site to build that. But of course, Cal's the lead engineer on Flickr. So for each station, it also pulls in photos from Flickr of that Caltrain station. And here's an example of the kind of thing you can do with Flash. This is Pirate Maps by Justin Everett Church. And he used the fact that Flash, the more recent versions of Flash, have full image processing capabilities built in, and they can apply filters and layers and convert and change colors and things. So here you've got a live map, and you can actually drag around this on the site. But he's rendered it to look like a pirate map. So he's added the sort of coffee stain effect. He's stamped a compass on. And in fact, if you zoom in and out by dragging the telescope at the top, which is pretty fun. And then he did the same thing again, but this time using radar. So again, it's a Yahoo map underneath. He's applied filters and transformations to make it green and to... I think he even has an animated thing sweeping around. Last year, I talked about the Flickr. Last year at Deconstruct, I talked about the Flickr Web Service APIs. So I wasn't going to cover them again this year, but it's always nice to go back and see some of the really cool things people have built with them. This is the Flickr Color Picker. Yeah, this is the Flickr Color Picker, which allows you to select a color and then shows you photographs based around that color. And there's a sort of interesting related concept here. This is Retriever, which is a fascinating application where you can draw in that little box. It's a little Flash widget, and you can draw sort of abstract shapes and things, and it will then find you matching photographs. They actually have to pull down Flickr thumbnails in advance and cache them for the analysis there. But that's a really, really neat tool that people have built. This is a fun one. This is Bubbler, which is just lets you pull in photos from Flickr and add speech bubbles to them. So build your own comic books. And this is one that Paul built. This is great. This is Favcol. You tag photos on Flickr with the tag Favcol. The Favcol site pulls them in and works out what Flickr photo's average favorite color of its color is. But of course, it always ends up as a sort of murky shade of brown. But it's still really fun. finally, this is this guy called FD who's built FD's Flickr toys, and every single one of these little links is some new toy that he's built with the API. So he went completely crazy and came with a whole bunch of really, really exciting things. So with all of that, that's the Yahoo Developer Network ties all of this stuff together, puts it all in one place. And I guess the point we're making here, which is kind of obvious, what happened there?
I don't know.
Keyboard got jammed, I think. Is that web services aren't just for internal use. You build these things, as a large organization, you build these things internally, and they're really useful. But if you expose them out to the outside world, you get, as Jeff was showing, you get people build stuff that you'd never dreamed of that's really exciting and gives people a platform that they can develop on as well.
That's pretty much all we've got to say. We'll just go over what we've talked about. These are some of the things that we've found to be true at Yahoo about web services. First, as I was talking about, they make huge sites possible. Without web APIs, it wouldn't be possible to build something on the scale of Yahoo. Second thing Simon talked about was that web APIs allow us to build new products faster. It cuts our development time. It gets us to the point where we can ship a product quicker than we were able to before. They help us innovate. It means that we can build products faster. We can spot the good ones. We can spot the bad ones. And we can find ideas that we didn't think were possible. and that web APIs aren't just for internal use. Now, we're a really huge company, and it's really easy for us to stand up on stage and say, well, we've got a team of 1,000 engineers and look at the wonderful things we're doing with web APIs. But there's a whole bunch of you out there that are probably working for much smaller companies and probably thinking, well, what does this actually mean for us? And I think that this is still worth knowing about. The first point about scaling maybe isn't particularly relevant to you right now, and it's much more important for you to get your product out the door than to worry about how you're going to scale it in 2 years' time. But the other three points are really valid and really pertinent, particularly if you think about APIs provided by us or Amazon or Google or eBay as something that you yourself can use to get your products out quicker and help you innovate. And as Jeff said earlier, these aren't just about mashups. There are lots of companies that are around that are making a profit based on services provided by us and other companies. We have a commercial licensing scheme just like Amazon does. You don't have to come talk to one of our salespeople. You do have to go through a slightly more difficult process than if you're doing something for personal use, but it is possible. And we'd encourage people to do that. This is part of the long-term trend across the industry that building a website is getting cheaper and easier all of the time. It used to be the case that you'd have to spend a few million dollars on infrastructure if you wanted to launch a .com. And you used to have to write your own software from the ground up. You had to write your own templating engine. You had to write your own database access. And now you've got frameworks like Rails or Django or Catalyst that make that much easier. And you used to have to find all the data yourself, but now you can use ours. Of course, there are times when you wouldn't want to use public APIs, but it's an option that you need to be aware of. Jeremy's coming on next, and he's going to be talking about the technical details. So hopefully we've led into his session quite nicely. But the last point on the slide is, I think, the most important one in our presentation. And it's valid for everyone, big or small, whether it's a personal website, a simple mashup, or something the scale of Yahoo. And we encourage everyone to think about it. Find a way to contribute back to the ecosystem. If you've got some data that's out there and you can find a way to get that out in public, then you should do so, because someone else will build on top of it and someone else will do something that you never thought of, and it will create something amazing and you'll make more money than you thought was possible. There's a whole bunch of interesting business and corporation models out there. We're only just scratching the surface of what's possible, and the more people that get involved, the better it's going to be.
So we've left a bunch of time for questions, and I think we'd like to open up questions about any of the stuff we've been talking about, the web services, especially things like the developer network. So what are we going to do here? Do we get the lights up on the audience?
The other thing is we've got free T-shirts for anyone that asks a question. So
maybe asks a good question, but yeah, we've got quite a lot of T-shirts. So. They're quite nice too.
Hello.
Hello. Okay.
Hi. I'm just wondering about the mapping data you have on Yahoo compared to the Google Maps, especially for companies countries outside the US.
So that's a really good point. The mapping data that's available through the API, at the moment we have satellite data for the whole world. We've got we have sort of high-level cities and major roads and railways and things for the whole world, but most of the detailed data is still in the US. And obviously this is a major concern, especially to the Flickr team, who had to put this thing out, and then most of the feedback they got about the feature was, well, it's very nice, but I live outside the US and I can't find the street that I live on. So the good news is that the Maps team are working to resolve that. They've they're working out the deals, they're doing all of that stuff, and the timeline for that appears to be months rather than months rather than anything longer than that. So yeah, better data is coming online for those.
And it's worth noting that Google's coverage isn't perfect worldwide either. Yes, ours is pretty patchy outside North America, but Google's is almost non-existent in some areas of the world, whereas we do have something for everywhere.
This stuff is very difficult. You have to do different data deals in different countries. So it takes a while to get the data and license it in a way that you can let people reuse.
But we're working on it.
Do you have something in place for using a Yahoo API and, let's say, an Amazon API, and you've got rates going for both? If you're a developer and it's like you've got, let's say, location books and travel books, you're using a Yahoo map and so forth, but it's like you're using both of them and there would be a pay structure for both systems. So if you're using S3, do you have a system within your developer network to say, oh, this is how much you would owe
at the moment, and others? At the moment, the payment structure is it's based on most of the APIs are for non-commercial use, and you can email a team at Yahoo to sort out commercial usage as well. And again, this is something they're looking to change in the future. I don't know how many of those plans are public.
It's not true of all. I mean, the Maps APIs, you can do commercial use.
You'd have to check the fine print, yeah. Unfortunately.
Hi. How can you make sure that the APIs will still be available in the future?
That's a question which I think is that really applies to the whole spectrum of APIs and the whole. Yeah. It's one of the things about the whole Web 2.0 movement that people don't talk about so much. I think basically for that kind of thing, you need to start talking about partly about sort of commercial APIs and the whole sort of service level agreements and that kind of thing that you get. But also at the moment, I guess you go on goodwill.
Well, I think it's worth bearing in mind that the alternative, you know, if you want to be completely self-reliant, then you've just got to do a hell of a lot of work yourself. And so, you know, if you want to use our stuff, then you've got to take it on trust that we're still going to be around. And, you know, we're not going to go anywhere anytime soon. So, yes, there is the possibility that the business unit that's providing a particular API might be shut down, but we would definitely give a lot of notice, more than enough for you to find alternatives.
I think the interesting thing about this is something which hasn't yet really been put to test, because the whole web service API stuff is so new, we're still waiting for the sort of test case of how that's going to work out. And I think it's in everyone's interest who's involved in this sort of nascent industry, not to upset people and drive them away from their own services. So there's a major incentive for organizations like Yahoo not to mess up if ever that becomes an issue, because they'll lose the trust of the developer audience.
And I think pretty much everybody here is sold on the idea of web services APIs, but how do you sell them to the sort of higher levels of management if you're in a more traditional company where this data may be considered sort of proprietary? How do you go about getting the sort of change of mindset with the higher management?
There needs to be a business advantage. If you are a company that's sat on valuable data that you're making money that you're making your money out of, then you do obviously need to make the business case for what you're going to release and if you're going to release it for free and things. So I think our talk, part of the thing we were really trying to get at is the importance of APIs for internal usage, which avoids that kind of issue entirely. But yeah, that for external stuff, I think it really depends on the company and on the data that's being revealed, that's being released.
Yeah.
But then there are case studies like eBay and Amazon and companies that are benefiting enormously in financial terms from the APIs they've released. So it really depends. It's a case-by-case thing.
I gave a talk at a conference in Amsterdam a few months back, a conference called XTech, which is about exactly that issue, the issues companies have with trying to release their data, the reasons why they might not want to do it. And there are some pretty good reasons not to, particularly if you're sat on a really valuable source of data, you're the dominant player in a particular market. Why would you open up the data? You're just basically throwing money out the window. Now, there are a whole bunch of reasons why you'd want to. For a start, if you're the first person to move in a particular space, then you get to define that API space. So the first company to release Maps APIs got to define the basic paradigm that everyone followed. Delicious was the first to launch in the social bookmarking space with an API, and every other social bookmarking site implements Delicious's API, which means that Delicious get to basically define the basic functionality that a social bookmarking site should implement. And if you're not the dominant player, if you're an up-and-coming company, then by opening up your data, it gives you an advantage over the incumbent. So if you look at the Maps APIs that are out there, you'll notice that you get different data from the proper Maps website to the API version of that particular map. And often they come from different data providers, and that's because the data provider that has the best data, the major player in the market, doesn't want their data to be open for free. But the smaller upcoming guys who are trying to find as many ways to get their name out there, to get their data out there, to find interesting uses of their data, are happier to cut maybe more interesting deals, take a bigger risk, because how else are they going to gain market share?
From the bigger provider's point of view, that's then the risk is that if you don't start getting involved in the API thing, one of your competitors might, and it might allow them to completely eclipse you.
And something you can do, which is something that we started out doing, is start by doing it for non-commercial use, and then over time find ways to find business models that work that allow people to pay. I know Amazon have actually taken the opposite approach. They've started with made sure that every single one of their APIs works as a business model in of itself. And that's a really interesting thing to do as well. You know, if you can actually just get money for this, then all you're doing by having an open API with a pay-for model is you're getting rid of the salesman in the middle. Almost every company that has useful data is selling it, but they've got a team of salesmen who go around selling it, and you can get rid of them. Saves you money.
Get out the middleman.
A question about how many of those mashups and prototypes have you taken on board back into Yahoo?
Do you mean in terms of the internal Hackday stuff?
Actually, I was talking externally, but actually the Hackday stuff as well.
Oh, okay.
There's a really obvious example.
So last year, I stood up here and I was talking about Flickr APIs, and I said, so my absolute favorite mashup ever is geobloggers.com, which is this site that has a map, and you can pull in your Flickr photos, and you can drag and drop them onto the map to set the location. And sure enough, Dan Catt, the guy who did Geobloggers, was hired and now works on the Flickr team and built most of the Flickr maps thing I showed you. So that's a great example of taking external innovation using your APIs and rather than ripping it off, just like hiring the guy. So that's kind of that seems like the smart thing to do to me. I thought that was a really nice development.
I mean, the success of an API or of a mashup or a use of that API, it's not just about finding new products for us. It's also about just encouraging the innovation across the marketplace. The old saying, a rising tide raises
all ships,
which I hope isn't on the buzzword bingo.
yeah, how is that going? Anyone getting close?
You know, we don't just measure the success of our APIs by how many things we've managed to bring in-house. It's also about encouraging an open ecosystem where our data is just part of the data that's out there on the internet. And that brings us strategic advantages, and it means that other companies can make money themselves. It's a win-win situation.
And I think that's all the time we have, unfortunately. We'll both be around for the rest of the day if you want to ask us questions about any of that stuff. But thank you very much.
And anyone who wants their T-shirts?
Oh, and come and get your T-shirts.